just for boys.
Rob's here from Edgar Magazine. Tell me you had buttercups.
Of course, and daisy chains. I know this is supposed to be the men's section, but yeah, we did the sort of thing at school, yeah.
Mostly it's a very British thing then, obviously.
In order to talk to girls, really. Yeah, you would. The girls would make enormous daisy chains, like going on metres and metres. And then I think they just sort of left them in the playground and they would just shrivel up and die, sadly.
Which is a bit of a shame, actually, looking back.
But the buttercup, yeah, do you like butter? You'd twiddle it underneath your chin, and if it glowed yellow on your skin, which of course it did with everybody, because that's just what happens when you hold something yellow underneath your skin, then it's like, oh, you like butter. And that was the game.
Was this a mad ad campaign from the butter people, do you think, back in the day? Is that where it started?
I just think an old wives' tale. You know, like dangling a wedding ring over a pregnant lady's bump to test if it, you know, clockwise is a boy, anti-clockwise is a girl.
I haven't heard that one.
It's that thing, yeah.
Is the buttercup's like a sweet? What is this thing?
A little yellow flower.
Oh, it's a flower.
Yeah. It sounds like an American chocolate bar.
Yes, that's what I was thinking the whole
time. Buttercup.
I love that. So what did you used to do at school on a day where the weather was different and you could go out? I guess it was always warm, was it?
Yeah, we had very temperate weather where I was. It was either a little bit cold or a little bit hot, but we did a lot of playing outside. But we didn't really... Later on, we got jungle gyms and stuff, but that was like later on. We were very excited about those. But in the beginning, everybody just played on the rocks and coppies because where, you know what a coppie is?
No.
A coppie is like where boulders of rocks are sort of balanced on top of one another. It's kind of like that's how they were worn with erosion and the earth changing, blah, blah. And we would play on there with like sticks and rocks and things.
Goodness me. Health and safety wise, I bet they're not allowed to play on them anymore. It's like bouldering at school without a helmet.
I like how you call them jungle gyms, but at my school, they were just called climbing frames.
Yeah, but do you remember your school would get a new one? Like, there'd be a huge investment from somewhere. I don't know where it came from, and there'd be a new one.
Yeah.
New climbing frame.
I think it was a parent, because when it happened at our school, it was somebody's dad had actually made this thing.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah, this massive thing. We're like, whoa, that guy's dad's cool.
Oh, the memories. I'm feeling very nostalgic today. So we're going to talk about travel and entertainment from a gentleman's perspective. If you have any gentlemanly questions, feel free to send them in to Rob. And we're going to start with an interview that you did recently.
Yes, I spoke to the author, William Dalrymple, who is an authority on India. He's written 7 or 8 books on India, all about his travels, all about the history of that amazing country. And, you know, he's got there's a lot of material there for him. So he's a very successful author and journalist. He writes travel for the Financial Times and all these really, you know, good proper newspapers. And he's got a new book out all about the Koh-i-Noor, the famous Indian diamond that is... kind of a notorious history.
So this was one of our selections for book club last week.
Was it really?
I think last week, yeah.
I'm taking it on holiday with me next week. And I can't wait to get stuck into it.
It's meant to be good.
Indian history is just wonderful. Those Mughal emperors, they were crazy people.
He's a really interesting guy. He lives on a little goat farm in Delhi, doesn't he?
He does, on the outskirts of Delhi. And he's very posh in English. But he said, yeah, I live on a goat farm on the outskirts of Delhi. Like it was the most normal thing in the world. Like he was living in, you know, Arabian ranches.
Yeah.
Like, oh, right, okay. And he's, you know, when you talk to him about travel, as I was, you start to feel quite boring. Because there you are going to Spain and France and Italy. And he's talking about, I took the kids to Afghanistan last year trekking. And, yeah, it's pretty great. You know, the scenery is really amazing up there.
Huh?
And you think, oh, right, okay. He said he brought his son and they met President Karzai. And so they had birthday cake with President Karzai in Afghanistan.
Wow.
And that sort of thing doesn't happen to me on holiday, does it?
No, and imagine growing up with parents like that.
Yeah, I know. Well, this is it. This led to a whole discussion about how you should take your children on these adventures and travels because it makes them confident, it makes them wise, it exposes them to all these different things. It's a really valuable gift to give to kids, I think. And so does he. That's why he insists on taking them on these amazing adventures. He did try and take them to a villa in Tuscany once, he said, and his children sort of said, no, Dad, we want to go to Pakistan. We want to go and climb the mountains or something in Afghanistan, you know. So
that's fantastic, though.
Yeah, really good.
But he has also travelled extensively throughout the Middle East and Syria in particular. He's one of those lucky people who actually got the chance to go to Syria. And this is him talking about his experiences there.
Syria then completely peaceful, utterly gorgeous, totally seductive. No tourists going there because the regime was quite fierce, but the friendliest people. I hardly spent a night in a hotel. Everyone would open their doors and at first you thought they were going to kill you or rob you or something, but they were just the most hospitable people. Syria's an incredible country, or was an incredible country. It's one of the last countries in the former Ottoman Empire, the Middle East, which still retained what India has, which is that massive variety and diversity. Taking this deeply interwoven fabric of different nations that was there and polarizing out into separate colors, like taking a carpet apart.
Such an interesting guy.
And a great talker. You know, he's one of those people. He's one of those people that talks in fluid sentences. You know, he talks like he's reading from a great book.
Yes.
But he's not. He's just a very eloquent man. Very interesting. Very, very well travelled. He was telling me about getting stuck in Himalayas in landslides, and you know, the truck broke down in a river in India. And just these stories just come tumbling out of him. You know, we're lucky if you get one of those stories every 10 years of your travels. But
yeah,
he gets three of them on every trip.
Did it make you want to travel more?
Yeah, it made me want to go, you know, back to places like India, you know, and we were talking a lot about where a beginner should start in India. I've been to India quite a lot, but I was just asking for tips, you know, for beginners. And he said, well, you know, Rajasthan is the classic area, you know, with the deserts and the forts and the temples, Taj Mahal, etc. But he said, also, you've got to think about Madhya Pradesh, just to the right of Rajasthan, which has some amazing temples. And he said, obviously, India is such a huge country and you can only cover a postage stamp size piece of it, but just try and explore these slightly off the beaten track areas. You know, they're not in the wilderness, they're still towns with roads and things, but great things to see away from the big hotspots like the Taj Mahal.
I haven't done India yet at all.
Never?
Never. I've always felt like, because it's so close, I wanted to go a bit further.
And me too. I feel like I don't know enough about it because I feel like I need to be educated by somebody from India before going there, because otherwise you just go to the touristy places.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's okay, because the touristy places, it's not like a touristy place in, you know, Florida, which has hats and mugs with, you know, I heart Florida. India still is pretty untouristy, if you know what I mean. You'll see tourists around these great monuments, obviously, but still you'll feel like you're in, you know, a very different kind of place to where you've come from. And really, you know, like I said, because it's such a big place, you've got to try and pick a zone or an area. So if you pick the Rajasthan, that state, and just focus on that, you'll be fine. Just fly to Delhi and start there.
Did you speak to him about anywhere he still wants to go? Is he one of those people who's been everywhere?
Yeah, he was talking about like sort of jungles of South America. I'm trying to remember now, but I'm pretty sure he's never been to South America, which I found very surprising. But he was we started talking about how much we love Indiana Jones. And he said that he loved those films and he wants to go and explore those Amazonian jungles and all that Mayan architecture, all that sort of stuff. So I think South America is next on his list. But I mean, the man is so in love with India, I think he might find it hard to tear himself away from that country.
We have a lot of listeners who listen in from India. If they've got any tips on where you think maybe is the best place to start off on a trip to India,
yeah,
please do text in and let us know. We are looking for the less touristy sites. I know you say they're not very touristy, but Taj Mahal.
But it's brilliant. Taj Mahal is a touristy spot for good reason, because it is totally breathtaking. But then I went down south to this place in Tamil Nadu, called a town called Madurai, which I'd never heard of. And I kind of read it by accident in a guidebook the night before. You know, I was in a little hostel. I thought, Madurai, that sounds pretty interesting. And there's this amazing temple, multicolored temple, very psychedelic. And as I approached it, I sensed the atmosphere just start to build. And there was a tension, there was a buzz, you know, a good tension. And there's a temple in the middle of these little tiny streets. And it is multicolored. It's like a big rainbow thing. And you think, wow, you know, I've never heard of Madurai. I've never heard of this temple. It's probably not going to be in the top 10 things to do in India. But wow, what an experience.
They're the things you want to do.
Yeah, and I mentioned this to William Dalrymple. I said, oh, you know, Madurai, for example. And he sort of threw his arms up in the air. He said, yes, Madurai, it's amazing. It's wonderful. So it kind of gave me confidence that I'd hit something that was pretty good. You know, it wasn't just an accident. This place is worth seeing.
Yeah.
Just for boys.
Rob is here from Edgar Magazine. We're talking about India. Good place to kind of get initiated with India if you're a new tourist who hasn't been before. And Hisham texted in and said you could start in South India, Kerala, especially in the monsoon. That's the place to be. I would avoid Goa if you want a non-touristy place.
Yeah, I would agree with Hisham there.
Good advice.
Rajasthan is great though, because that's got all the history, and I think that sets the tone
history
for the rest of India. You know, if you learn about the culture and the history and how India was formed, then that spreads out to the rest of the country. That would be my my tip.
Keep them coming in. Tips on India, please. You've been catching up with a celebrity chef, I believe.
Yes, Jeffrey Zakarian, who's got lots of shows on the Food Network and the Food Channel and all those kind of things. He's a very, very well-dressed, tanned, smooth-talking chef.
Mm.
I loved meeting him. He was really, really great. He was kind of on the hoof. Just caught him in Dubai. And I knew that he worked at Le Cirque in the 80s. Now, Le Cirque is a New York restaurant, French restaurant, and it's a legendary place. If you talk to any chef and mention Le Cirque, they'll sort of start, you know, like bowing down in appreciation of this real legendary place. Can you believe, so I was asking about it, when Jeffrey Zakarian started working there in 1981, can you believe there were only 6 French restaurants in New York City?
No.
6 in 1981.
Seems unreal.
There must be 600 now.
Yeah, so, well, 6,000.
Well, so Zakarian said he came out of the Culinary Institute, you know, as a graduate. He was 22 years old, and he walked into Le Cirque and said, "I want a job." And they said, "No, come back tomorrow." And he said, "I'll work for free." And they said, "Yeah, okay."
As he would.
As he would. And so he worked there for free for 6 months because he was so determined to make it, and he knew that this is where he would learn his craft. He said he was terrified because Le Cirque was a pillar of French cuisine in New York, as he called it. And he said this was the 1980s, early 1980s. These were the politically incorrect days when chefs would shout and swear and throw dishes at you and spoons at you if you weren't doing the right job. And this is Gordon Ramsay times 10, okay?
Mm.
Gordon Ramsay would not survive 5 minutes in this place.
You don't think?
Well, maybe, I don't know. 1981, it was tough back then.
Yeah.
He was working, so Jeffrey Zakarian said he was working 100-hour week, so 10 a.m. till midnight.
Can you imagine
that in a
just
blazing
cooking,
hot kitchen?
Cooking all day.
There'd be nothing else in your life.
For no money, for no wages, you know?
But where was he living and eating? Was he probably taking scraps from the life?
He said he was living in a very disreputable hotel, if you know what I mean. And he said it was dirt cheap. He was borrowing money left, right and centre just to survive, you know, and have this place. Which was terrible. And then one of the chefs got injured, burnt himself or something, and he got a job.
I'm just imagining injured.
Well, yeah.
I'm just kind of wondering.
Sabotage, maybe.
Slipped on a banana skin.
So he was then got a wage of $114 a week in 1981 or 1982. Not great.
It's not great, even back then?
No, he said it was not great. So he was able to move into an apartment, which was, I think, 2 subways, a bus ride and another bus ride and a half an hour walk next to a cemetery.
I love people with such humble beginnings, don't you?
Well, especially now that, you know, he's wearing Armani suits and he's got 4 restaurants in New York and he's a millionaire. But so he said he had no social life. He was permanently exhausted. He said he was white as a ghost because he never saw daylight, never saw sunshine. But at the end of the whole interview, I said, "But did you love it?" And he goes, "I loved it." He said, "I learned everything I know. It made me the chef I am." He said all the guys that he worked with, they were all trying to survive. And all those guys have gone on to operate Michelin-starred restaurants. It was a breeding ground for great chefs back in the 80s, Le Cirque. And so the reason I was talking to him, here comes the relevance part, is that Le Cirque opened in Dubai a couple of months ago. It's at the Ritz-Carlton in DIFC. So if you want to go and taste a little bit of history and hopefully get some of that New York atmosphere rubbing off on you, go to the Ritz and DIFC and try Le Cirque.
I've been. I really enjoyed it.
Did you?
Yeah, I really, really like it.
Is it very, very French?
Work crowd. No, it doesn't feel too French at all,
okay.
Actually.
Which is not a bad thing, of course.
No.
Oh, that's right.
Did you talk about Donald Trump?
No.
Aha.
Does he know him?
This was on Fox News last year.
Today, Donald Trump has taken on an Iron Chef, just not in a kitchen. Trump facing questions today from attorneys for celebrity chef Jeffrey Zakarian. You've probably seen him on the Food Network. Back in August, Trump sued Zakarian and another big-time chef, Jose Andres, for backing out of plans for restaurants in Trump's new Washington, D.C. hotel. They did that after Trump said Mexico was sending criminals and rapists into the U.S. Well, lawyers for the chef say Trump's comments doomed the restaurants before they could even open. Trump's attorneys say a deal is a deal.
Wow.
Good for Jeffrey.
Yeah,
standing up to Donald
stuff,
Trump.
Eh?
Yeah, he's got principles. Good. I like him even more now.
So, staying with food,
yes.
We are going to be talking about some manly restaurants, aren't we?
So manly. Well, especially the Lions rugby is coming up this weekend. It's Saturday morning, 11:35 kickoff UAE time, I believe, which is
a nice time.
Perfect for the guys, yeah. And so I went down to try Nezasorsi, which is a rugby bar in downtown, the Mansell Hotel. Michelle, you're looking very misty-eyed.
No,
this is your kind of place.
I have been there before, and there's so many South African accents as you walk.
Yeah.
Not just South Africans, but it's like a haunt for the game is on. And I was just thinking 11:30, nice time, because normally, you know, the games can be like awful times when you're here in the UAE.
Yeah, they can.
Yeah.
Everybody says it different, guys. I would say Nezasorsi.
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 Is it Nezasorsi?
I have no idea. What kind of restaurant is it?
Let's call it Nez, just for argument's sake.
It's a sports bar.
So it's a sports bar, but it's a good sports bar. It's a little bit elevated than a regular sort of trashy sports bar. So this weird name is a combination of New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, hence Nezasorsi. But there's rugby shirts everywhere, signed by all these rugby greats. There's rugby balls everywhere on the shelves. It is rugby paradise.
I was in there last weekend, actually.
Oh, were you?
Some friends suggested that we go there. And the last time I was there before that, I remember all the lights being on really bright.
Yeah.
So I'm glad to see they've turned the lights down a little bit, which is good. But then when I was in there last weekend, all I could notice was they've got the bar in the middle.
Yes. Okay,
but then they've got so much weird stuff in vending machines. And I was like, who's going to the vending machine for stuff?
Well, during half time, you know, you want to, I don't know, take a walk around the place.
It's like they had a meeting and went, what should we put in a vending machine?
Really?
And they couldn't decide. So instead they got 7 vending machines and everyone got to put their stuff in, whatever they wanted.
Hey, I bet it keeps the tills ticking over.
You think so?
Those vending machines. Yeah, easy money going in there.
Mm.
But the food is great. You know, if you want somewhere to go and watch the game, they are going to show all the Lions matches, of course. They do these huge platters for 99 dirhams. They do huge burgers and sandwiches. It's a great place. They'll do lots of deals, loads of screens to watch the rugby.
Boys' food, I'd say.
Absolutely right. You know, it's all big, comes in wooden boards and baskets, that kind of thing. So the first game, 11:35 on Saturday, and then the next Saturday, and then the third and final test is July the 8th. It is the place to watch Lions rugby. Trust me.
And somewhere, are we going to go more upmarket now if we're heading across to Switzerland?
Well, from the so from New Zealand, South Africa, Australia, then Switzerland, a semi-new place I wanted to talk about. It's called Publik. And it's great for guys because everything is very cheesy. It's a very Swiss menu. It's a very Alpine menu. And the whole place, it's in Zoutmadenat, and the whole place, Publik, is based around a Swiss ski chalet.
I've seen it. It's underneath Folly.
Next door to, well, yes, underneath next door to Folly, you're
I
right.
I walked in for a look the other day. Yeah.
It's very peculiar, isn't it?
But
it's kind of good fun. Now, if you're just melting in this Dubai heat, as of course you are, go there because it's nice and sort of cool and chilled, and you might psychologically feel like you're in Switzerland in the snow because they've got a TV screen playing with a real log fire. And they've got heavy red velvet curtains. Everything is wood. There's skis hanging on the wall. There are ski boots sitting on shelves. The DJ stands in a ski gondola, you know, a ski lift.
Yeah.
So
they got the aircon down really low?
They should, shouldn't they? Yeah.
Well, not for the planet's sake, but...
No, but if you want to just go and fake cold, if you're just melting in the Dubai heat, go there and check it out. The food is good. They've got, you know, a burger with sort of cheese fondue and beef burger for 98. Onion tart for 38 is very good. So it's a good place. Zoutmadenat. Always a nice little spot to take visitors.
Have you ever made cheese fondue yourself?
I made it? No.
It's really difficult.
It's too complicated. I would never try. Mm. Yeah.
I've tried a couple of times. It just won't work properly. So it's well worth paying for it.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that you bet off. Because sometimes I'll go out and if it's going to be a pasta, I'll think to myself, could have made this at home. Could have maybe made it better.
Chicken breast. Don't bother.
Yeah.
The fondue, can you imagine?
Piece of salmon fillet. No.
Yeah.
I know how easy that is, thank you very much. But fondue.
Can you imagine the cleanup operation after a cheese fondue?
Huge.
Or the washing up would be pretty tough.
I'd hate to be that person.
Yeah.
With all the fondue pots in the back.
I'd be interested to know what kind of cheese they use as well.
You get different kinds of cheese, don't you?
They're very particular about what kind of cheese they will use.
They blend them.
Yeah.
That's the trick. And often these chefs have secret blends that they won't tell, like Ruya. And their cheese and egg pide thing. They have it's a 3 cheese pide. Two of them, they tell you what they are, but he won't tell me the third secret.
Like, it's regional as well. I know when I went to France and then we went to the mountains, they were like, no, in this area, we have a fondue with these cheeses. And in that area,
really,
you have
it
with this cheeses. And it's very, very...
And never the twain shall meet.
I don't know.
Cheese wars.
Just for boys.
Well, we're just talking about a restaurant there with Rob from Edgar Magazine called Publique, which is a ski chalet in Dubai. And we were talking about the fondue they do there. And I do love it when you send in the sarcastic text messages. They're always welcome, along with the rest. So you can't melt cheese, somebody said. Let me tell you, it is so much more difficult than melting cheese. I thought that's what it was.
It's not just melting cheese.
There's flour involved.
There's complexities, yeah.
Oh, there's all sorts that you have to think about. And you have to do it at different times, and you have to make sure it doesn't get to anyway.
And you can't burn it, because burnt cheese tastes awful.
Awful.
Yeah.
And then you have to keep it warm afterwards, or it just turns into another block of cheese.
Yes, that's true, yeah.
All sorts, Mr.
Science.
Sarcastic. And we did, there was no name on there, but we did click it. Thank you, Andy, to find out. There's an exhibition going on, Rob.
Yes, well, it starts July 27th, but it's in London. And I thought if people are travelling around, they might be nearby. It's all about the Rolls-Royce Phantom. Which is pretty much a Hall of Fame car.
James Bond's car, isn't it?
No.
Oh.
It's more like the rappers, right? The rappers all have those.
Well, it's the royal family, folks.
Oh, sorry.
I mean, come on, we're going a little bit higher than
Queen Liz. Sorry.
Well, no, I'm sure Diddy has in one time owned a gold-plated Rolls Royce, you know.
And so, Daniel Craig?
No, probably not. He's an Aston Martin boy.
Yeah.
So the Rolls-Royce Phantom in its debut in 1925. And so this exhibition in London, they're going to bring... That there have been seven Phantoms, like different models through the years, since 1925, almost 100 years. And so they're bringing one of each of these seven Phantoms to London for the first time, all under one roof. And they will also reveal the eighth, the next generation of Phantoms, from July 27th in Mayfair in London, Rolls-Royce. It's going to be the poshest event in London this year. It's going to be great.
Do you think it'll have changed much?
Yeah, well, that's the thing, because... We looked at lots of photos. We did a story on this in the magazine. And if you look at all the photos, you know, it's kind of like watching a little baby grow up almost to when they graduate university. You can see there's some consistency there, but it's really interesting the way that time and designs of the time just impact on the design of the car. So just a little bit here and there, you know, and it evolves into the car that it is today. So the first, I didn't know this, but the first car they made in 25, it was codenamed Eastern Armoured Car, because Rolls-Royce didn't want anyone to spy and work out what they were building. So they called it Eastern Armoured Car to make people think they were building a military vehicle. And they left bits of military plating and bulletproof material around the factory in case any spy saw it and thought, Rolls-Royce are making a military car. I should go back and report this. But they weren't. They were making a luxury vehicle. And that was the first Rolls-Royce Phantom, 1925. They made one for Prince Philip and Princess Elizabeth in 1950, before she was queen.
Wow.
They made one for the Queen's Silver Jubilee in 1977. That same car was the car that Kate Middleton travelled to Westminster Abbey with her dad to get married.
That's a great fact.
Yeah.
Have you ever been in one?
I've never driven or sat in a Rolls-Royce. I was thinking this morning, actually. And that's a shame, isn't it? That's something I should tick off my life list.
I've got a great Rolls-Royce story, sort of great.
You crash one?
No. It's what I think about when someone says Rolls-Royce.
Yeah.
I don't think about James Bond, really. I think about this. So when I used to work as an estate agent, we had really expensive properties.
Mm.
And some of them were in the city. They were flats. And there was one for £1 million. And a guy walks in from the street one day, tatty jeans.
Yeah.
You're trained, obviously, not to judge anyone by what they're wearing.
Sure.
So he walks in and he tells us this big story about how he's won the lottery. And we're just like blown away. Like, I can't believe it. Anyway, so he's been to Rolls-Royce. He's bought a box at St. James's Park, which is a football ground in Newcastle.
Yeah.
Been to Rolls-Royce. They are busy stitching his name, his initials into the seats.
Really?
Yeah. And he's done all this and he tells us, you know, I haven't got the money through yet because I've just won. I take the offer on the flat. It's all going ahead. And then a couple of weeks later, the police come.
No.
And they tell us that he was actually a patient somewhere and hadn't won. But I spoke to the Rolls-Royce guy, he's like, yep, he was in progress.
And I wonder if they had to take the stitching out or try and sell it to a man at the
same
initials.
Find someone else the same initials. Yeah.
Cool.
Isn't that a great story?
What a con artist. Wow.
I know.
But yeah, it's the ultimate symbol of luxury and that you've done all right for yourself.
Absolutely.
My mate drove one once in Dubai and he said it was weirdly smooth. It felt like he wasn't really driving a car, or it didn't feel like he was actually in motion because it was such a smooth ride. And that's what they're famous for, Rolls-Royces, just the comfort, the elegance, but just no bumps. You know, the suspension is so amazing, you won't feel a thing.
And you know, we have so many famous cars, not famous cars, but expensive cars in Dubai.
Right.
Whenever you're at the traffic lights, you tend not to notice them anymore, do you,
right.
really?
Yeah.
But when you see a Rolls Royce, you always look to see who's inside.
Yeah, right. I mean, you see Ferraris, Lamborghinis, and you hear that noise, and you sort of, yeah, whatever, you know. But you're right. When a Rolls Royce growls past...
You think he's important or she's important.
Yeah, yeah. They're very... They always strike me that they're very, very large. I always think, must be an absolute nightmare to park.
Yeah.
Can you imagine parking that? I'm all of the Emirates.
I always think that too.
On a busy Friday morning.
And you'd need lots of parking spaces because you wouldn't want anyone to scratch it.
No, you'd have to, yeah, really go for those space on the top floor where no one else parks, right in the corner, yeah. away from everybody.
Yeah. Grooming-wise, what have you brought in for us today?
Well, it's from Thierry Mugler, who was a French fashion designer. Kind of a brand that I had forgotten about, to be honest with you, but he's still making lots of fragrances. Now, the bottle is rubber. Can you feel that?
Yes, it's a rubber bottle, and it's bright kind of turquoise colour.
It's the, it's the Tiffany green colour, isn't it? It's that classic Tiffany colour.
Now, I would say this is like 13-year-old boy present.
It looks very... What's the word?
Young.
Young, I guess, yeah. It's very flamboyant. It's got a big star on the front of it. And it's by Thierry Mugler. It's called Amen Cryptomint.
Have you ever smelled Wish?
Kryptonite Cryptomint. No.
Chopard's Wish. Or Angel, which smells very much...
These sounds like mum's fragrances from the 1980s.
Nah, it's a fragrance that I think every girl who's about my age would have been into when she was in her 20s.
Oh, I see.
For a short period of time. And then after that, whenever you smell it, it makes you feel a bit sick.
It's a bit like Impulse Body Spray.
Yes.
You had that and you're Xena, yeah, okay.
But this reminds me a little bit of that smell.
Well, it's got peppermint in it. This is the slightly unusual thing, which I think is interesting. Yeah. And geranium and patchouli.
Mm.
So it's very fresh, very zingy, very light fragrance. That bottle you're holding there, Steph, is 100 mils. And the price for that is $315.
I think that
dirhams.
Dirhams. I was going to say, that's very expensive. That would make a great gift for a young guy, I think.
It looks cool. I mean, I've never seen a bottle of fragrance look like that in a turquoise rubber bottle. It's called Amen Crypto Mint.
I have some fragrance news as well.
Do you?
That I think you might be interested in, yeah.
Do spill.
So there is a perfume maker. They've tried over the years to bottle every kind of smell, as you can imagine. And he's been working on something that I think could be the most sought-after scent of all time. It's the smell of money. Take a little listen to this.
So the idea for this composition was really quite simple. Could I capture the smell of the paper itself? Could I capture the slightly metallic scent of the ink? And then could I capture the scent of humanity and the hands that the money has passed through? From a new note, where you smell the rawness and the freshness of it, with just a few hands having touched it, to something which smells without any question, as though it's passed through the whole of humanity's hands.
Do you know what I think of when I hear that?
Oh.
I think of the coins that are in the cup holder in the car.
Yeah.
The heat has been getting in the car all day. There's like a little bit of old coffee that's spilled on the bottom of there. And if you were to pick them up, how they'd smell.
That's not a good smell.
It's a horrible smell.
And no offence to my fellow man, but I don't want to smell something that's been through, what was it, the hands of humanity?
Yeah.
That just smells a bit sticky.
Have the hands of humanity been washed?
I don't think they have. Hand sanitizer. It's a great idea. It's a very good gimmick, but... I mean, I like the smell of paper. I think he's onto something there. You know, I think that's a very nostalgic
a new book
smell.
Has got a very nice smell.
About books or school books or exercise books when you were a kid. That paper smell is quite nice.
Used money, though. In fact, you know what? Look, I've got in my pocket. What's this? This is a 10 Polinski. Okay.
What's that?
This is Polish money. I'm going to throw it at you. Have a sniff and tell me what you think. Let's see if we could make that into a nice eau de toilette that people would actually want to buy. Give it a big whiff.
Okay, here we go. It smells a little bit chloriney.
A
little bit. Have you been swimming in your jeans again?
That's been in there with the tissue, so I'm so sorry. I've got a bit of a cold.
That's not the most. I mean, I'll tell you what. I know when you go on holiday and you get currency from the Bureau de Change,
yeah.
And it's brand new crispy currency. That is a good smell. The smell of American dollars. I love that smell.
I don't think I've ever smelled it. Do you take it off the guy and go, money?
Yes, I think this is fine. No, that is a really good smell. Honestly, dollars, they smell different to £20 notes or dirham notes. Fresh American dollars, great smell. It's the smell of capitalism. That's what it is.
There you go. And we're going to need some man wisdom from you before you leave.
Damien Hirst. artist of the 90s and still going strong, very, very rich man, so
killed
successful.
So many animals. See how many animals he killed the other day? Something like 465,000 animals.
I presume they were already dead, though.
No, I don't think so.
You're joking.
Nope.
Oh, well, he's got a new exhibition called, you ready for this? Treasures from the Wreck of the Unbelievable. It took him about a decade to make this exhibition. Cost him tens of millions of pounds, and it's on in Venice right now until December. And we did a story about him in Edgar magazine, and his man wisdom is this. He said, "We're here for a good time, not a long time."
I'm sure he nicked that from a fridge magnet. I've seen it somewhere else before.
I think the fridge magnet nicked it from him. He's a very he's a very enigmatic chap, is Damien Hirst. I think he's very cool, and he's full of little pearls of wisdom like that, and he's got a very life-is-short attitude. Which, you know, it's exciting. He's a good guy.
Rob, thank you so much for coming in. We will see you after your holidays.
Yes. Have a great summer, everybody. Yeah. Bon voyage.
Have a great time in England.
Thank you.
Just for Boys.